Hey, how's it going? And welcome to Haydn Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Dr. Amy Hillis, who is an assistant professor of violin at York University's School of Arts, Media, Performance, and Design. She also is a founding member and manager of the Horizon String Quartet, as well as a member of the Canadian duo Megan and Amy, and has toured across all provinces and territories in Canada. And we'll be talking about tennis. Welcome, Amy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for the intro, Patty. It is so nice to chat with you. It feels like, as we were saying, that it's been a while, but at the same time, like it was just yesterday when we were playing Ludosofsky Quartet together in San Francisco.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the like kind of slightly infamous Ludosofsky String Quartet that I've talked about with previous guest Ivo Bokulik
as well.
I mean, we've clearly met before we decided to play Ludosofsky together, but I don't know about you, but for me, that was such a special project.
I totally agree. In fact, I can back that up by saying that I then went on to do about 5 years of doctoral research based on Ludosofsky's music.
No, really? Yeah. I didn't know that? Oh my God, that's so interesting.
Comparing that and the quartet by Henri Dutilleux, which I think maybe, I know that some people played it in San Francisco, not when I was there, but anyways, it's another quartet, and Dutilleux and Ludosofsky knew each other. Anyways, not to get too in the bubble and nerdy, but basically, I then went back to Montreal after playing that quartet with you and had been given some really good advice of if you're going to do a doctorate, do it on something you really want to dig your teeth into and like you know, really research in depth. And so, well, Ludosofsky's music was an example of that.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. That's so awesome. I'm like so curious now. I should read your dissertation.
Right. I'll send it to you for some light reading.
Some light reading. Well, I personally also like, I don't know why, but his music, I'm always gravitated towards his language, the way he writes things and like the sounds that he creates from our instruments, especially in that string quartet too. It's just like, what? Like, who does this?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And I felt the exact same way. And then I felt that with his other music too, especially for violin and piano, violin and orchestra. And,
Subito.
Yeah. Exactly. Subito and then the Partita was a big one. And I was lucky to even play the version with violin solo and orchestra.
Oh, cool.
Basically, all this to say that I was fascinated by this idea of, okay, why is it that his music speaks so directly to musicians and performers? How can we as performers then share that enthusiasm for this language with audience members? Like, I remember when we did it, we had to think a lot about how do we introduce this piece to an audience, because it will be something that no one has heard anything like this before.
Right.
It's, for those of you who don't know the piece, it's very aleatoric, which means that there's a lot of parts where the coordination between the instruments is not specified. He just wants you to play this for these many seconds, and then when the cello goes bop, bop, then you stop, and then you do something else. And so, okay, how do we make this not just sound chaotic and like noise to an audience? How do we really bring them into Ludosofsky's world?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go.
Thanks. Wow, holy crap. Clearly, you've done your research on how to talk about Ludosofsky. Yeah. No, it's great. And I mean, a good entryway is not just the string quartet, but I would probably direct them towards Subito as well. As
totally.
A good first,
and that also has like, I mean, I wouldn't say that he called it programmatic, but he did write it towards the end of his life. It was inspired by illness and struggle. And so basically this idea of it being very uncomfortable and intense, but this piece for violin and piano, it's very short and sweet, and it maybe not sweet.
I was gonna say, I don't know about sweet.
But Subito means sudden, and that's very much what this piece is in both character and duration.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so sorry, word bomb.
That sounded like some Ludosofsky. Yeah.
Right. So clearly, we met before. We didn't enter together, right? I think you entered. I was a first year master's at San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and I think you joined a year later. Is that how that kind of worked?
I think so. But then, so I started in 2012, fall of 2012.
Yeah.
But then we definitely played together in my last year of my master's. So I think
because I did the artist,
you did the. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
So I did the 4 years there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Got the timeline down. Yeah. So I don't know why, but there's certain little nuggets I always remember from A, just being your friend, but B, like you as a colleague and watching you perform, watching you learn, like alongside with me. There's a couple little things, like one that popped into my head earlier was there was one time you were playing the Shostakovich Piano Trio. It wasn't a masterclass, but it was with Paul Hirsch in the room, I believe. And maybe Axel, I think, might have been there too. And you, I wouldn't say it was a meltdown. It wasn't a meltdown, but there was like a moment you had, you took, you're like, I don't feel like I am worthy of playing Shostakovich. And I just, it made me just stop in my tracks being like, yeah, she has a point. I'm not Russian. I've never gone through a mass genocide slash a world war and or just oppression from or censorship from above. Like, who am I to play this music kind of thing? Anyway, it just was like such a thought-provoking thing. But then like,
oh man, I know exactly the moment you're talking about. And yeah, honestly, I feel like not much has changed for me since yeah, saying that, because that really puts it in the nutshell of I've always struggled with, okay, I cannot relate to this composer who has been through hell, his family's yeah, been through hell, his country's been through hell, mm-hmm, and he's writing about others, specifically those who were killed and murdered in the Holocaust, how they've been through hell, and mm-hmm, how me, the white privileged girl from mm-hmm, the prairies in Canada, an extremely, you know, I'm extremely privileged and extremely lucky, mm-hmm, how do I get into the mindset in order to convey the emotions Shostakovich wanted to convey in his music?
Right.
And I still struggle with that. And honestly, part of my solution has been, well, how about I play music by composers that do share some of my background? But I'm playing some Shostakovich right now, is practicing it this morning. So I still love to play, you know, music that challenges me and gets me yeah, outside of my bubble. But I do have this struggle of, well, who am I mm-hmm, to be this vehicle for this emotion, even though it's one of the greatest pieces ever written? I mean, mm-hmm, of course you want to play it. Of course you want to bring something to it, but I don't have that experience. So how do I get into that emotion and then create it for others in the audience? Anyways,
right.
I totally remember that moment. And part of the problem is I don't remember what Axel or Paul said.
I don't either. I think they didn't really know what to say, frankly, because yeah, like none of us, I mean, with your criteria that you presented, it's like, well, none of us should be playing, only Russian people from that particular
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right. which therein is an answer, is that, well, yeah, we can't. So that doesn't mean we shouldn't play it.
Right.
It means that, you know, maybe we can bring something from our own take or perspective that can somehow bring out maybe something new in his music, or not, or maybe yeah, someone, you know, I think there's not really maybe an answer, but that doesn't mean, at the time, you know, I was this angsty graduate student of like, why am I doing this if I can never get there, you know? But now I have a little more perspective, and it's not that simple. It's still worth doing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but I guess my point of even bringing this story up was just to say, like, you always asked very introspective questions mm-hmm, that would so easily be overlooked in some way. And so I always really respected those moments that you took to be like, no, wait, guys, like, what are we actually doing here? Like, what is this? You know, and it always shifted my focus in that way. And I hope and like to think that I learned from you in that way, and like, hopefully try to continue to do that. Just awareness wow, of like what we're doing. Yeah.
Hey, thanks, Patty. I feel like you just gave me your own inspirational pep talk. So thank you.
Well, and also like, I think that's always going to be the struggle. And I mean, especially now that we're, you know, I think the shift towards trying to be inclusive of more cultures, more people of color, women's voices. These questions are as valid as the one that you just presented about Shostakovich, who is a dead white composer, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not like this question is ever going to not, it's ever going to
be relevant. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Like, no, I totally agree. And I think that that's a nice way for all of us to just keep rethinking, okay, mm-hmm, what are our roles as artists and as performers, mm-hmm, and how can we be some kind of conduit between what other people have to say with their compositional language and where they come from and their voice and their perspective, and how can we also add our own style or perspective, but
yeah,
exactly, and in this collaboration then somehow be a representative of this underrepresented voice in some mm-hmm, way.
Yeah, well, okay. I know we just went like right straight to the deep
right
end
into
there.
It. Just into it. Oh man, this is why I miss school. Just these conversations. Seriously.
Yeah, totally. Well, can you tell me what your most insane performance story is?
Okay, so you prepped me on this question, and I've been thinking about it for the past week, and I was like, okay, what would be just generally objectively an insane performance story? I was like, well, maybe the fact that like I performed on top of a mountain once, but that was for my friend's wedding. So the performance itself was pretty mediocre, but it was also like involved me taking an instrument I had on loan, so very expensive, up a ski chair and play it on top of a mountain. But somehow that doesn't seem like, to me, it's not like a huge moment in my life. It was fun, but like, and then I was like, okay, well, maybe there's something that happened on stage. And one time when I was young, so I grew up performing, we didn't do it a lot, but I have three sisters. We had a family string quartet, and my youngest sister was the other violinist. She's 5 years younger than I. And once we were performing at some final festival performance, and I could just see, I think we were performing a movement of Dvorak American Quartet, but I could just see this. We had been at the cottage the day before. I could see this tick crawling up her face.
Oh my!
During the performance, and being the champion that she is, and also not wanting to let her three older sisters down, she grins and bears it to the point that, like, it was almost more distracting the way she was handling the situation.
Yeah.
Like, such gumption.
Yeah.
But to be fair, that is also something that, you know, we laugh about as sisters, but I don't know if it's maybe my most crazy performance story. So with that pretext, I'll maybe just tell one story that I personally, so again, maybe it's not objectively crazy or insane, but I personally think that it was super cool. And this is part of the Horizon String Quartet's programming, which you alluded to in the intro. Basically, we do a bunch of shows for school kids. So usually big assemblies of schools. We did 7 tours pre-pandemic, and each tour would have about 40 concerts in them, and they'd be in the prairies and in Manitoba and Saskatchewan in Canada. One of the programs we put together, I'm to this day really proud of, because basically it was the extremes of the string quartet. So the craziness to me was, not only did we do the shortest piece, we did a piece by Webern. We didn't do the longest piece. We didn't have time for that.
Well, no.
But we did, we talked about Feldman, but we didn't play it. And then we did the quietest piece, and then we did the loudest piece for string quartet, and that was this piece by R. Murray Schafer, the third quartet, where basically you have to yell and you have to go bada 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 bada, and you say all these syllables together as a quartet. And what was super cool was we invited the whole assembly of kids to sort of be a part of the action. And we would do this, you know, 40 times as part of this tour, and it did not get old. And it, to me, brought the craziness out of the string quartet, out of the players on stage, out of the audience members. And it was like, it's an experience that, as I say, may not be objectively the craziest, but it's one that I always remember, because to me it was very visceral. And to me was, as I say, a way to totally break down that third wall between the performer and the audience. And I just really try to do that in what I do. Not to say that I yell in all my performances.
No, right.
But in some way that you can like make it extreme, make it out there, make it something that moves an audience member. And that can be with the most delicate, beautiful melody you've ever played. But, you know, it can be in so many different ways, but in some way just like gets the whole energy of the room synced up. Yeah. Check out R. Murray Schafer's piece. St. Lawrence String Quartet is an amazing recording of it on YouTube. It's one of those great pieces for string quartet.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I'll start practicing my vocal warm-ups to
That's it.
Like, I can only imagine what that must have felt like. And it's, to me, it just sounds so rock and roll.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. And yeah, that's a really good analogy, because it's, we've all been to a rock and roll concert where you've got the lights and you maybe have a fog machine and you've got people like using their cell phone lights and sync and waving, whatever it is. And you just feel like, well, no matter what's going on musically, I mean, usually the music also
music.
usually that, but the whole experience, it just feels like, oh, you're totally one with everyone in the stadium, the audience, whatever. You're all focused. You're all part of this sensory experience, which after 2 years of a pandemic, I am thinking about more than ever, because it's that feeling of feeling the same thing together.
Yeah.
That I really miss.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Again, it's objectively maybe less crazy, but in my head it was like, yeah, you know, super crazy and something I think about as yeah, the as good kind going. Of crazy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Go for it.
Okay. Mahler or Bruckner?
Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Debussy.
Cats or... That's no.
a hard one. Sorry.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Appetizer or dessert?
Yeah, I'm going to go with appetizer. I like my tartars too much.
Okay. Sparkling or still water?
Sparkling.
Fan favorite question. Alternate universe musical instrument?
This is really boring, but piano.
How's that boring?
I've always wished I could play the piano. Uh-huh. Like, I can get around, but like, I've never been given lessons. And yeah. I just think it would be so cool to have so many voices at your fingertips.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Probably professional pianists out there are like, there's too many voices. Give some back. Return. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, totally. Yeah. Piano is, that was my first instrument. And I'm so grateful to have had that. But yeah. Just like.
You have the best of both worlds because piano and cello, you get the most expressive instrument in the cello. So even if, you know, you can't move between the notes in piano, you certainly can in the cello.
That's, well, fair enough. Yeah. Outside of voice, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Fair enough.
Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Red wine.
Okay, fair, yeah.
Again, kind of boring, but yeah. Not, you know, just like in a way that's like, okay, all of a sudden it was okay to have a nice glass with your pasta on a Tuesday night.
And, yeah.
You know, it's very French. It's very civilized.
Do you have a charcuterie board or anything like that?
Oh, exactly. I feel like I've only been getting like charcuterie boards and cheeses and meats as gifts like for Christmas and everything. It's yeah. just like, oh, here's another beautiful charcuterie board. Fantastic. Let's yeah. make use of it.
Favorite professor shout out?
Oh, well, Ian Swenson.
Okay. Shout out Ian.
Yeah. yeah.
Anything specific that you wanted to share about your experience with him?
That's a whole other podcast series. We should just have one dedicated to
Ian Swenson.
What we like about Ian.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it really goes along with, it's funny when you said earlier in our conversation that you thought I asked questions that would constantly sort of reevaluate what we did as mm-hmm. musicians. And to me, that was very much what Ian always did all the mm-hmm. time. So everything from, well, why are you using that fingering? So the minute details, boring technical things, to more importantly, the, well, that's great. You learned the whole Tchaikovsky violin concerto for your lesson today and it's memorized and wonderful, but I don't care. That doesn't make, I literally don't care unless you say something by doing it, unless mm-hmm. you actually have a reason for doing it and not just the fact that you're being a good student or whatever. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying I was always a good student, but I'm just saying like there had to be meaning behind what you did because we all know there's people who can play anything and there's people who can get around our instruments much better than we can. And it's wonderful to be able to have that technique because then you can say even more and you can do even more. And so we constantly are building towards that. But if you're losing sight of what it is you actually want to say and who you are as a person and what you have to give to the music and what the composer is trying to say through the music, then it kind of doesn't, well, in Ian's words, it doesn't matter. So yeah. Ian, I think about that every day. And that's one of the many lessons that he would not only teach, but he would show in his own work.
Totally. I also, what I personally always appreciated, I mean, there's so many things as well that I love about Ian, but one thing is that he always was inspired by whatever he was doing outside
yeah.
of his instrument. I suppose in some ways that's kind of an inspiration for this podcast. But
totally.
But, like, I remember there was one time I was at Tanglewood. We were doing the Opus 44 number 2 Mendelssohn String Quartet last movement. Mm-hmm. It's very nice. Fast. And he was at the time like watching a lot of documentaries on the cosmos.
Yeah, totally.
And so he was talking about the start of my note because I guess everyone kind of starts that last movement, but like he was talking about that, like the Big Bang, and it's just like,
yeah.
Like, how do you capture that kind of energy force in one articulate note? But right. yeah, it's just like something like that where he always was incorporating and trying to connect it back to some kind of bigger idea or universal idea in some way too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what it did, I mean, once you realize that everything that came out of his mouth, in my opinion, was never meant to be taken personally. So mm-hmm. it was always about the music. Mm-hmm. So for example, if he says to you, well, well, I didn't get anything from your performance. It's not because he doesn't like you or he doesn't respect the fact that you tried. That always goes without saying with him.
Yeah.
It's because what he's trying to do is he's trying to actually give you the tools and the inspiration and the realization that, well, if you don't say something, basically, this is not working the way you might think it's working. Mm-hmm. So here's what we need to do in order for you to really say something. And it's not about you. It's about the music. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that was incredibly liberating because it was like, okay, it's not about me as the violinist and he respects me, he appreciates me, we can go have dinner, no problem.
Right.
But when it comes to performance and when it especially comes to the teacher-student relationship, it's all about the music. So mm-hmm. anything he tells me is coming from a place of, can you get that music off the page more? Mm-hmm. It's not ever coming from a place of, you did a bad job.
You know,
it's not about you. And that's incredibly liberating.
Yeah. Well, hi, Ian, if you're listening.
Hi, Ian.
We miss you and everything. Okay. Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Yeah, honestly, these musical heroes, like I could, there's a few answers that come to mind. If I'm to go outside the classical genre, I recently just finished watching one of the most recent Beatles documentary where they showcase mm-hmm. them like rehearsing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like 40 hours. It's fascinating because, so for example, McCartney is the one in this part of their lives, which is at the end of their time as a band together, where he's just kind of like trying to say, look, we need to get this done. Like, let's do this. Let's do this. And Lennon's the one who's just like, let's just have a screaming jam, even though we have a performance in a week and like, we don't know what we're going to play. We haven't written the songs yet. Uh-huh. But he's like, let's just like get it all out there. I actually didn't find myself leaning towards one or the other or to Ringo or to George. But what I did respect was the fact that they were always able to, in the end, work as a team, even though it was so clear that they were all so different. Like, mm-hmm. of course, they shared similar values, etc., but like they were going in totally different directions as individuals. Mm-hmm. And what was cool is they never made it crazy dramatic, at least from what we saw. And we get some pretty intimate insights. And I mean, it honestly really reminded me of working in a string quartet.
I was like the whole time, like, this is a string quartet life. Yeah.
It was so inspiring, Patty. You should mm-hmm. definitely watch it.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, okay, obviously these people are world renowned for what they do. That's great and everything. But what was really special to me was how they worked together and how they got past differences and especially how they recognized. So like at one point, George Harrison actually leaves the band mm-hmm. and John basically talks to Paul saying, okay, here's our hangups with him. Here's his hangups with us. Here's what we need to do in order to kind of bridge that. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's like, it's again, not making it about themselves, making it about the music. How mm-hmm. do they get back to the point of creating music? So that's a very long-winded non-spitfire answer for you. But there you go.
That's fine. So the Beatles, in other words.
Yeah, right. Also very unoriginal, but
no, there's a reason why they are the best bands to have ever existed.
Yeah, hard to dispute.
Yeah. Most transformative performance experience?
For me, it actually probably goes back to when I played with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada. I was 17. I was still living in Saskatchewan, had not gone to university yet, so relatively sheltered. And that summer of performing with them and touring with them, I realized that they were like-minded people across Canada. Mm-hmm. who were not just really good at their instrument. That wasn't what actually attracted me and vibed with them. It was actually the fact that they were just really fun, interesting people with mm-hmm. an interest in music and specifically mm-hmm. with playing in orchestra. Because up till then, my experience playing in orchestra was mainly with either older people as part of the Regina Symphony or people in youth orchestra that just did it on a Saturday and that was sort of the end of it. But this sort of opened my mind that, oh, I don't have to go and do something academic at least right away. Like, I mm-hmm. can actually pursue this passion and I can do it with people who aren't just violin drones or mm-hmm. aren't just, you know, but are people that have interests outside of music and are really cool people. And so let's go try that. And honestly, without that experience, I don't think I'd be a musician today.
Wow. Yeah.
There you go. That's probably transformative, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. No kidding. I mean, that's what convinced you. I mean, that's answering part of, you know, your musical origin story. Like, what convinced you to go into music? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was definitely moment. One of the main reasons, yeah.
Okay. Desert island piece of any genre?
Oh, of any genre, I'm going to have to stick with classical music, and I'm going to have to say the Heilige Gedankengesang in the middle movement of Opus 132, Beethoven.
See, that's another thing I remember. I don't know why I have all these little nuggets of memories of you. I'm not trying to like stalk you or whatever. I don't know why, but I remember
I'm
you were like,
honored.
But I remember that you always were like, 132 is my favorite Beethoven string quartet.
Mm, yeah. I mean, that movement, after having a bit of time away, so I haven't actually performed it since, 2012? Because I performed it right before coming to San Francisco, so that's probably part of
the
reason.
That's why, yeah.
Yeah, but that middle movement, I introduce it to these young undergraduate students who have never, they're not string players themselves, they're musicians, but not string players, so they've almost certainly never heard this piece before, and when you give the backstory of how it's him overcoming sickness, and not just physical sickness, but I think also mental sickness and stress, and almost like an existential crisis, you know, with Beethoven, it's all about the struggle, but then he sees some hope, and especially when you're a young person, you're just like, okay, if Beethoven could see hope, I can see hope, and this is what hope sounds like, and it's transcendent. So yeah, I always go back to that movement if I want something inspiring.
You know, I remember the first time I returned back to that specific movement when we were preparing for this cycle, our Beethoven cycle, and this was late 2021 after all this pandemic stuff. And the first time I played it with my colleagues in the Artari String Quartet, after we finished, I had to take a moment for myself because I was just like, this encapsulates how I was feeling and still am feeling throughout this pandemic. Like it like was this internal healing I didn't even know I needed.
For
And performing it was like, I really hope that there's some way that I can give that to my audience, or like that healing that Beethoven gave to me in that one rehearsal, you know?
Yeah, and that's really, that must be hard. Yeah, to like really also feel it while you're performing it, but then also try and transmit it too. Like I already feel kind of overwhelmed when I'm listening to it, let alone, as I say, I haven't performed it since 2012. So it's been a while, and I don't know what that experience would be like now. Like, I can only imagine that it would be an interesting challenge to feel it 100% while also trying to communicate it. But maybe that's actually very normal. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think for me in that rehearsal, it was like, that was the one that I needed for myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the performances, then, this is what the other people might need. Yeah.
Right.
So that it wasn't totally on top of each other. At that point, I got the healing I needed. Yeah, but it was just one of those moments where I was like, this is why I do what I do. But I didn't know.
It.
You know what I mean? It's like, you don't know until you do it. And then you're like, oh, wow, that was magical. Anyway, yeah, definitely. Totally. It's worth the 20 minutes of music.
So. That's it, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, you finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Thanks, Patty.
Thank you. Bows. All right, Amy, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover music? How did you discover the violin specifically? You already told us one reason why you decided to take it professionally, and continue that story until where you are today.
Yeah, so I was really lucky, again, privileged. I grew up in a family that valued music, that valued being able to play an instrument, but then also play with others. And so I started violin at age 5. Honestly, I don't remember. I don't have a story of myself like, I want to play the violin. I don't necessarily know if I was the one to choose it, but I do remember playing it for my classmates in kindergarten and feeling really empowered would be the right word. Proud
special?
And boastful would be the selfish word, but like, special that I could play this instrument, and I don't think anyone else I knew, at least in that class, could. And so it was just something that felt unique to who I was. And then honestly, what kept me engaged, what kept me going, and that's right from starting Suzuki and doing group classes to throughout elementary and high school playing in orchestras, that what kept me engaged was this playing in groups and playing with other people. I never wanted to play violin for the solo aspect of it. That was a means to an end. That was, you know, in order to get better, in order to develop, in order to understand the instrument better, do solo work so that you can play in string quartets, so you can play in orchestras. And then playing with National Youth Orchestra, that was really like an eye-opener of, oh, this doesn't have to just be a hobby. hobby. Like, I could actually try doing it. Because in high school, you can't touch the violin. I mean, I wasn't an early bird, so I didn't get up at 6 to practice. So
yeah.
You're in school from 8 till 4, and then I would usually have ballet or some whatever after
extracurricular.
Yeah, so then you don't actually...
Homework.
Yeah, so let's say on a good day, 4 o'clock is when you touch your instrument. Well, all of a sudden, half your day is gone, and it's a different thing. Whereas in university, you can get up and practice your instrument for the whole morning, and that's part of your schooling. And mm-hmm. that changed it from just being something else that I do to, oh, this is really, I can feel myself while I'm doing mm-hmm. this. So again, I mean, probably goes without saying, but when I entered university, I was technically not as proficient as most of the people in my year, most of the violinists. I had a lot of catching up to do because I had simply not put in the same amount of time. I was juggling a whole bunch of things in high school. And then in university, I had an amazing teacher who really could sit me down and say, this is the game plan. I know you're musical and I know you want to do all these things, but in order to do all these things, you need this technique and we need to really, you know, hunker down and get that technique to where it needs to be. And then you can start really developing projects. So school, whether it's undergrad, master's. So I did my undergrad in Montreal at McGill, then went to San Francisco for my master's, which I really felt that vibe at the conservatory there had a real emphasis on music making together, specifically mm-hmm. chamber music.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly empowering. You learn so much from each other. And then I went back to McGill for my doctorate, where then it was more of a focus on, okay, what are my specific interests and what projects do I want to create, whether they be with a group or solo-wise, in order to dig deeper into those interests. And that's when I started really realizing what I could give to communities, to society mm-hmm. as a violinist. Then I started doing these projects like the Horizon String Quartet and my duo with Megan, where then instead of the school sort of saying, here's what you need to do in order to basically build the tools you need, instead of following a plan or some kind of template or taking instruction, I created what I wanted to do. And mm-hmm. I created, okay, this is my goal. How am I going to do this? The Horizon String Quartet is probably the best example of that, where I was mm-hmm. just like, I loved it when I was in elementary school and professional musicians came and performed in my gym to the whole school. I want to go and give that opportunity to students in rural and urban areas in Canada. How can I do that? And that was a totally grassroots effort. Mm-hmm. That whole quartet came together just under that vision specifically.
Yeah. How did you do that?
Well, we were really lucky. So there were, first of all, get like-minded people. So mm-hmm. you know the other founding violinist, that was Joshua Peters. He's mm-hmm. also from Manitoba, mm-hmm. so, which is neighboring Saskatchewan where I'm from. And he was really into the idea and really helped support the groundwork for that. And then the violist was, well, at the time we had like 3 violinists who one would also play viola. He grew up with me in Regina. Again, kind of same mentality. Now he's principal second of the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra. So mm-hmm. professional musician, but wanting to give back. And then the cellist also from Manitoba, but went to school with us in Montreal. So all of us being professional musicians, that was really important, but people from the prairies and mm-hmm. recognizing that all it needs is a few more kids on the prairies just need more exposure to this music. It's not inaccessible in terms of the content. It's just mm-hmm. inaccessible in terms of where they are. Geographically speaking, they might not be able to hear a live string quartet. So then we just got some grants. Initially, it was the province of Saskatchewan, the Arts Board, that got some grants. And we worked, basically, you just cold call schools and you just say, hey, this is what we're going to do. Are you interested? And then you feel out what is most interesting to teachers and students and you mm-hmm. incorporate that feedback. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was definitely, again, a positive reinforcement of, okay, it takes a lot of work, but if you have a strong idea, something that you feel passionate about, there's always a way to make it work. The idea itself has to be really convincing.
Okay, so that's the Horizon String Quartet. You also are a part of the duo Megan and Amy. How did that come about?
Yeah, great question. So Megan is also kind of coincidentally, but also not 100% coincidental. She's also from Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. She grew up on a grain farm, so her family still makes their income off of harvesting wheat and other grains. And basically, when I was growing up in Saskatchewan, I would see her at festival, but we would never play together because she was from 2 hours. You know, she lived on a farm quite remote. Basically, I knew that she was an amazing pianist, and mm-hmm. I knew when she was coming to McGill in Montreal, I knew that that was a really cool opportunity that finally we might be able to collaborate together because I was still at McGill at the time. Mm-hmm. And so basically I approached her, hey, do you want to play a Brahms sonata together? I've got got this great teacher. I think you'd enjoy working with her. I'd love to work on this piece as a duo rather than let's just hire an accompanist who can play sure. with me for my recital, which yeah. is quite frankly usually how it works up in Canada, which is quite different from my experience, America. For example, in San Francisco. Okay, yeah, where you okay. have collaborative pianists that you work with on a consistent basis. Mm. In Canada, it was usually sort of just a few rehearsals before the concert. You'd put it together.
I see.
So okay. I really wanted to have this project with Megan as a starting point. Mm-hmm. So it went really well. We both had a lot of fun. Honestly, we didn't sort of think much of it because then I went and did my master's in San Francisco. But then when I came back to Montreal, she was still there. She had really sort of grown roots in the city. And I said, hey, do you want to play some music again? So then we started playing again. And the real thing that kind of did it was we applied to this Pan-Canadian Recital Tour, which was the first project that was put together by three touring organizations in Canada so that it spread across the whole country. And basically, she and I came up with a program concept that they accepted. And that was, okay, we're going to showcase Canadian works, but we're also going to pair each Canadian work with a traditional piece from, as you will, the classical canon of violin piano repertoire. So uh-huh. for example, a composer from Quebec, André Mathieu, very much influenced by Claude Debussy. So let's play mm-hmm. the Debussy violin sonata alongside his sonata for violin piano, Mathieu's sonata. So we sort of create these connections for our audience in order to provide context cool. for the Canadian works. Yeah. So we're given a 50 concert tour across Canada. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've made recordings. We made a debut album called Roots, which again, it's the same concept. What are our roots as Canadian mm-hmm. classical musicians? We just got back from a tour in British Columbia. So yeah, she's oh, wow. just an absolute joy to play with.
Yeah. Is Roots available on Spotify or other streaming platforms?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, just search Roots or Megan and Amy. It should come up.
Yeah.
iTunes, well, Spotify. Yeah.
We'll absolutely put it on the podcast Spotify playlist as well.
Thanks, Patty.
That's yeah, awesome. Of course. And tell me a little bit about how you got your job now as an assistant faculty in violin at York.
York University. Excellent. So technically, yes, you're right. I'm assistant professor of music, but I don't.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah.
No, it's fine because this. Why would you know? It's basically what it means is that I don't just teach violin. In fact, to be quite honest, in my 2 years almost of teaching there, I haven't taught any violin. So it's more just general music okay. courses.
Okay.
And courses in community music, which is kind of a bit of a tricky term, but any kind of music education that's approached from a place of, okay, we want it to be accessible. We want it to be flexible. We want it to reach a diversity of people. We'd want it to be reflexive in that if the students are interested in hip hop, we want to explore hip hop and then maybe explore other genres of music in relation to hip hop. Or basically,
yeah.
in some way, we call it negotiated. It's just mm-hmm. as much about the participants as it is about the leader, the person who's facilitating this musical experience, whatever that may be. Mm-hmm. So I'm also what's called the Helen Carswell Chair in Community Engaged Research in the Arts. So basically, what I do is I create these connections between, there's one particularly marginalized community in the Toronto area called the Jane and Finch neighborhood. It happens to be right beside York University. And so how can we create connections between the musicians at York University with these marginalized people who have musical interests, mm-hmm. but it might not be how to play a Mozart concerto. It might be, oh, well, I really like to sing, but I've never felt confident singing in front of people. So mm-hmm. like, how do I, you know, develop skills to do that? Whatever it is, but how do we basically share our enthusiasm for music with people who might be underrepresented in the whole music education public system. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it's been a new adventure for me because yeah. it's not violin-centric, but it makes me think differently, which I really appreciate.
That must be one of the most rewarding experiences to have. Because I think at the root of, like, at least me and I think you, that, like, that's all we're really trying to do. Like, mm-hmm. our instruments is just a vehicle for that. You know, that's just mm-hmm. how we connected. But I don't know. I like to think that, like, I mean, that we can all connect in a similar principle of expression in music and finding that healing feeling within our emotions and allowing that to be spoken and or heard in some way too, even if it's nonverbal.
Exactly. And I think that's partly what has always frustrated me. This idea of classical music being elitist, I think, comes from this misinterpretation of, as you say, like, it just happens that you play the cello and I play the violin. I mean, of course, we're happy to do that. We wouldn't have stuck with it if we didn't enjoy the instruments. But really, at the end of the day, it's not about playing the violin.
Right.
It's about communicating something and creating an experience. And if that's because I feel that Heiliger Dankesang from Opus 132 is a piece of music that everyone can get something from, I just happen to be privileged that I can play one of the parts required in order to make that piece come off the page.
Totally.
And that's so cool, but it's not about, it's like, oh, well, you've been playing violin for so long, you must be really good at it. It's like, well, that's like such a, not even
that's
anywhere
not the point.
Close.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what can I do with that? And if you can't do anything that touches people, or not touches, but challenges them in some way, makes them think about something other than whatever they were thinking about before, then yeah, then I don't, honestly, as I say, if I could do it using the piano, I'd do it using the piano. I don't know. But I have to admit, I love the violin. The repertoire is so good.
I mean, probably second to the piano and voice is violin. Yeah. There's just so much amazing repertoire for that instrument.
But you get string quartets if you play violin. So there you go.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Are you ready to take a break?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right, we'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So, Amy, what do you want to share with us about tennis?
Yeah, I feel like we could just have a tennis podcast. In fact, that's something, it's bizarre how many musicians I've met who are also tennis geeks. So I grew up watching tennis, specifically with my grandpa, specifically in the summer. We would watch Wimbledon together at the cottage. And so weirdly, I kind of became a tennis nerd before I even tried playing it myself.
Okay.
I went to Wimbledon. I saw Roger Federer. Wow. And it's definitely a bit of an escapist tool, but at the same time, I do find that there's a lot of similarities between being a musician and being a tennis player, specifically the mental games. So, like, I don't know if anyone knows the book called The Inner Game of Tennis. It was something Dorothy DeLay made all of her students read. She's a famous violin pedagogue at Juilliard. And basically, it's got nothing to do with music, but it's everything to do with, okay, how do you practice a skill? How do you refine a skill? How do you perform a skill? How do you mentally prepare to perform that skill in the performance if something's not going so well? How do you adjust mentally? So it's all the mental strategy. And I'm always fascinated by the mental strategies, the approaches, and then the personalities in tennis. Tennis does a really good job of making those personalities quite clear between the press conferences and between the extra videos and interviews they have, but you really feel like, okay, that player has that approach to their game because they're this type of personality, and how will that personality line up with this other personality, and why is it that so many of us gravitate to this personality when this other personality is actually winning all the tournaments? But anyways, so it's an interesting parallel to music. I don't think that's why I like it. I think I like it. Yeah, it's not the only reason I like it. I think I like it mostly because it's just really fun to watch and really engaging, and you feel like there's always a storyline. But now I do play it, and that's a lot of fun too. And you find yourself, anytime when you have to learn a new skill, it's extremely humbling because you're just like, wow, this... It's like when people tell me, oh yeah, I took some violin lessons. It was really hard. It's like, well, yeah, you maybe only took it for a year. You probably couldn't play more than Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. That's very normal. You know, like these are very complex, sophisticated skills that we're doing with our body. And like, I started playing tennis only, honestly, a few years ago. And I was like, and I had an awesome teacher. He happened to also be a violinist. Yeah.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
So he was like, you don't play tennis? You know so much about it. We need to get you to play
Fix
tennis.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, just one of these people who's kind of a natural teacher. So he was really excited to do that. But yeah, it's like not simple, even though you know exactly what should happen and you know all the strategy and everything. And you're just sort of like, but why did my body not do what I wanted it to do? So we can all relate to that. But yeah, it's a really fun sport.
So let's just get a couple little questions out of the the way. Who is your favorite tennis player of all time? Also, like, which tournament is your, I guess, is Wimbledon your favorite tournament to watch? Or, and like, why? And get, let's get some of those kind of basic questions nice. Out of the way first. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Roger Federer is my favorite tennis player. Okay. But I will say that Rafael Nadal is also, he has been proving why he is such a great rival to Federer, in the sense that he is such a foil in terms of personality, but he is just as positive, and yeah, like, you can totally get behind him too. And the most recent tournament he just won, he did so when probably everyone else on the planet thought that he was out, and just by pure grit did he win. So he's inspiring. But yes, to answer your question, Roger Federer, I grew up watching him. That's just who it'll always be. Yeah.
Why?
Because, so not only is his tennis game really beautiful to watch, and I use that term quite consciously, because he looks like he's a dancer when he's on, I call it the stage, but when he's playing tennis, he just sort of floats. Court. Yeah, exactly. But honestly, the main reason is, okay, so I don't know him, obviously, but from watching all the videos and the interviews and everything, he just seems like such a normal guy. He's very appreciative of everything he's accomplished, but he's not entitled, you know, he doesn't have a savior complex. He's always interested in learning from other people and what other people have to say. But then he's also so human to the point that sometimes it's extremely frustrating, because it's just like, okay, could you be like Superman for that one point, because that was the point you needed to win? But guess what? He got nervous. So even though he's one of the most successful tennis players of all time, we can all relate to him, because he gets nervous. He's human. He's had to figure out how to correct his mistakes. He has been able to have a work-life balance. I mean, from the little that we know, but he has four kids and he has a wife. He's extremely passionate about what he does, but he's never lost sight of what's important in life. So that's inspiring.
Yeah, it's like, sure, everyone has faults, but seemingly is like so good at what he does. And everything that, like, what we aspire for, I suppose, as musicians. Like,
exactly. And again, it's like, even though it's always seemingly about him, I really get the impression that in like press conferences, he again doesn't really make it about his own feelings. I mean, he's asked to talk about them, but it's more just like, okay, well, this didn't work. That did. I felt kind of crummy in that moment. That moment gave me new life. Like, it's very much he's talking at the same level as all of us. And there's something, you know, we see these people as celebrities, and they are, and they have earned that right. But at the same time, I think he's extremely relatable, and I think he's naturally come across that way, and that's why a lot of people gravitate to him.
Yeah. I know that Federer is a lot of people's favorite tennis player to watch, or, you know, favorite tennis player of our time, at least, if not of all time. But yeah, I mean, it's clearly warranted. And anyway, just... Yeah, I just,
thanks,
I guess,
for
I just
letting me just, you know, gush a little bit.
Of course, of course. So now, yeah, what about, which tournament is your ideal or most favorite to watch?
Yeah, I mean, the only one that I've been to in person, the main out of the four major ones in the around the world, is Wimbledon. And it is a very classy tournament, in the sense that they know who they are. They know everything from the colors they have to the gardens that are immaculately taken care of, to people treat you very nicely, to they have a very English, what they call, queuing system. So if you want to get tickets to see Roger play, it's very well organized, this whole lining up to get your ticket. And there's a real tradition there. And of course, sometimes traditions don't need to last because they need to change with the times. But I do feel that Wimbledon has a certain aura around it of empowering the players, because they feel like, okay, it's not about them. It's about the whole history of the sport, what it's bring, the joys, the sad moments, the tragic moments, and how are you a part of this history? And that's nice to kind of feel that whole family, not in terms of just the geographical who's there, but across the timeline.
I was going to think that maybe it's akin to like us going to Carnegie Hall and playing or something like that.
Totally the same. Yeah.
Maybe less organization, but...
No, know for sure. And that only, you know, Wimbledon's only 2 weeks out of the whole year. But no, you're exactly right. It's exactly the same feeling that, oh, wow, I get to dip my toe into something that's been
so historic.
Exactly, so historic.
And that's asphalt?
Actually, that one is grass. So
oh, that's grass. Oh, that's right. Okay.
You're really getting into the important details. I applaud
you. The U.S.
you.
One is.
Exactly. So the U.S. Open in New York, again, an iconic tournament. That's hard court. So is the one in Australia. The one in Paris is clay.
Clay.
The only one that's grass is Wimbledon. And yes, that's got its own. That we can debate another time. But what it means is that it's a much faster surface. So things go really quick. And it makes the strategy interesting.
Is that a part of the reason why you enjoy Wimbledon? Or is it just for the historic? Or like, is that your favorite court to watch tennis on?
I mean, it's my favorite court just because, again, that's what I grew up watching. That was the one I watched the most. So there's a nostalgia there. But I wouldn't say that I've picked it just because it's grass. But there is something really beautiful about seeing the green courts too.
Yeah, sure. You already touched on this earlier, but I want to dig a little bit deeper into your experiences now as an adult learning tennis. Like, myself, I've maybe picked up a tennis racket like twice in my life and hit a tennis ball and been like, well, this is hard. Okay. And then just like never found the right person to learn it with or whatever.
Totally.
Be taught it, was worried about getting tennis elbow, et cetera, et cetera. So can you be a bit of a guide of like how one even, I mean, I'm sure this might be redundant for people who already know how to play tennis, but like what has your experience been like to dive into this sport?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a really good question because there's no one simple answer. And I think one of the main takeaways, as I'm still learning, is that it's not a linear process. So you might feel like, I really felt how that forehand works. Okay, I really learned something today. Next practice, you might be hitting balls off court. Like it might just be like, okay, that day never happened. But then maybe three practices later, you're back to, okay, I really get where that forehand is. So it's very confusing as someone who wants to be kind of systematic in their learning and like, okay, I did this, now I do this, and then I do this, and then I'll get to here. With tennis, I mean, of course, there's efficient ways to practice, and you need a good teacher to help guide you. But generally speaking, I've found that it's not a linear process. It is long-term, but not necessarily short-term. So you have to keep that in mind. But then also, it's been really interesting as a musician to kind of realize that you really can use similar strategies that we have grown up using every day in terms of learning new skills, whether it's learning how to play the instrument or actually, okay, I have a day to learn the symphony. How do I go about learning all the notes in this time so that I can actually get from A to B? And those strategies really actually translate very well to learning a new skill. And what's nice about the physical sense of tennis is that you're not just worried about where your tiny knuckle is on your boat. You know, like it's much bigger muscles. And so but you see, can use your whole body.
I would find that worse because I'd be like, well, I don't know where it's coming from. Like, you know, it's like almost too big. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's why you do need someone who can watch you do it and say, okay, the reason why that ball went there was because your knee was pointing there. So we need to have your stance here. So you do really need someone, especially in the earlier days, to coach you.
Right. So you can almost think of like, of course, the mastery of tennis literally being like us when we're trying to do a giant shift from one note from point A to point B or note A to point note B or whatever you want to.
Totally. Yeah.
Like it's like over time you perfect like literally knowing where you're going to place that ball on the court.
Yes.
That's kind of wild to think about.
Yeah. And I would say there is a major difference, which is that they can miss shots and still win the match. In fact, they will miss many shots and still win the match, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas like we don't really get a second chance at that shift. I mean, it's the wrong way to look at it because it should just be about, you know, the execution of something, but it is a bit of a different mentality. And I have to admit, I have found that really liberating with sports, whether it's tennis or something else, but something physical where you can just do reps and you can play games and you can make mistakes and you can still get better. And that can also translate back to music because we can also make mistakes when we play and still get better. It's just sometimes, I think too often, we will be hard on ourselves for making that mistake and then forget about everything else that we did. mm-hmm. or we'll let that consume cloud our judgment. The... Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that, yes, that needs to be fixed, but it needs to be fixed while also keeping perspective of everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's easier to do that when you can lose a few points and still win the match.
Sure. But I also think that's a good lesson overall for us musicians is that, like, yeah, I mean, I know that's kind of what you just said, but that, yeah, it's about the long game. It's not about, yeah. And to me, that means like it's about the emotion and the storytelling that we do in our music is mm-hmm. the long game of winning the concert or whatever you want to call it, to having a good performance. And if totally. I mean, I'm not, of course, like, yeah, we try to make all the shots, like we try to make sure that it is going as smoothly as possible. But yeah, I mean, at least for just like, I remember being a student, especially at SFCM, like playing one note, just like a microscopically out of tune, or maybe just a little more, you know, just something that I felt, but knew that it wasn't, and just being like completely destroying the rest of my,
right.
Because I was like, oh, well, that's not going to be an audition take. And that's I was hoping this is going to be an audition take. Yeah. Right. You know, or that kind of thing. It's right. like, well, yeah, people can really learn, like myself, maybe when I was younger, from that idea of like, you can miss a shot or two. It's not going
to
kill you.
Yeah. And again, it has to come from like, what is your motivation for doing that performance? Is it to make all those shifts, or do you want to make all those shifts so that you can convey something that's much more exquisite than if you didn't make all those shifts? You know what? Mm-hmm. So like, I thought you put it really well. It's this sort of long-term, yeah. long game. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the hardest part of starting to learn tennis for you?
Yeah, I think the hardest part was just that I had watched so many hours of it that I knew what it should look like and what mm-hmm. should happen. And I just did not have the tools physically to make that happen. So like if the coach says, okay, good, but you want to go cross court on that shot. It's like, well, yeah, I know that. But I just hit it on the other side of the court, which I didn't mean to do, but I know what I should have done. And
so it's that internal struggle of like, yeah. I see, that's funny. How have you overcome that, or have you?
No, I mean, I'm not, I certainly can't do everything I want to do with the racket. But what's nice is that if you consider it a hobby and not a career, then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, well, that was fun. I got better, or maybe I didn't that time, but I will eventually. And that's okay that I am not at the same level as Roger Federer. I think right. that sometimes in music, that's hard because it's yes. like, why am I doing it as a professional if I'm not at the level of the greatest players out there, because they can do it in a way that's so much more convincing. And so that I find really interesting of, okay, and that was the reason why I had to kind of forge these new paths for myself, because I was like, okay, if I just do the path that Ian does, or the path that Axel does, or the path that all these great players do, that's a great path for them, but it might not be the one that I can do to the same level. And so what is mm-hmm. it that I can do that's somehow right. valuable without having to necessarily have the technical proficiency of Axel Strauss? Mm-hmm. See what I mean?
Yeah, so, I do. Yeah. You're finding your voice, in other words.
Exactly.
And yeah. your space in the field. Yeah.
Yeah. But tennis is nice in that it's yeah. okay if I don't have my own that. Voice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's for the enjoyment of the action of following through what you've grown up watching all these
That's
years.
That's it.
Maybe one day you can teach me how to play tennis.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I'd be happy to hit a ball around. Yeah.
All right. Can I ask you two final questions?
Go for it.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
Try to learn as much as you can from your peers as well as your teachers, because often your peers have just as much, if not more, to teach you, whether they know it or not.
Well, case in point from me to you, right? Like, I learned so much from you.
And I could say the same about you. I mean, this bubble that you have at a school is something that you don't have, at least to the same extent, after graduation. So you'll always be able to sort of see role models in your path, in your domain, even after you graduate, and people that are doing really cool things and people that are playing interesting stuff and recording and whatever. But the community at the school and the idea of just like growing as a person alongside other people who are growing as people and really trying to keep an open mind. And not, I think maybe to sum it up, I would say, don't try to figure it all out right away. Just like ask questions and just be exposed. And I've always been quite a goal-oriented person, but that's actually sometimes can be limiting because you want something to happen and you want to see some kind of result. Even if it's a failed result, that's sometimes more satisfying than no result at all, right? But really, again, I keep going back to the vibe at San Francisco Conservatory. It was this incubator of just ideas. And yes, of course, there was pressure to play well, but the pressure more came from inside yourself of just like, oh, okay, everyone here cares so much about the music too, the faculty, the students, the whole group, everyone in the audience. So like, how can I convey that to the best of my ability? And yeah, I don't know, just like that might be throwing a few things at the wall and see what sticks. And then you can kind of hone in once you've experimented and once you've got all those ideas from other people, not just yourself, from other people. Okay, what is it that I really can get on board with or that I can really contribute, and try that and then try something else.
Yeah, I definitely second that piece of advice. I think I was so impatient with my learning. And
I mean,
just
we
like,
only have like 2 years for some of these degrees. And so it's like, oh my gosh, I have to get the do most this out by of the this. End of 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And my second question, as we enter a post-pandemic world of some sort, I don't know what's going on anymore, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue and what would you want to shed?
I love the fact that I've connected with people like you from different parts of my life, largely through new initiatives. So yes, of course, the easy answer is Zoom with people from around the world. That's great. Yeah. But I also think that if we do that as a substitute to actual human interaction, that's problematic.
Right.
But that being said, the fact that you're doing, for example, a new podcast that came out of basically a pandemic project, that has allowed us to create connections, to reunite, to talk, to chat after having some new perspectives. Mm-hmm. And you're not the only person that's had these sorts of projects. So I think to me, it's an example of thinking outside the box, of being flexible, of not just sort of staying in your lane and then not realizing what other people are doing. But I just want to say, Patty, it's such an honor to be a part of this podcast.
Oh my
because
gosh.
Not only is it super fun to talk with you, but it's really a privilege to be able to look back, to chat about ideas, discuss these perspectives with you as someone who has now moved from San Francisco, has relationships with people all around the world, and I'm tuning in from Montreal, and we can connect on that. And I mean, that's
it's
really
pretty
cool.
Awesome. Yeah, well, thank you. So what's something you want to shed, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. Let's not be hard on ourselves, and let's just keep experimenting. As long as
don't
it
limit.
Comes, don't limit. And as long as it comes from a place of, okay, I'm trying this not for myself, but to see what myself can offer others. I don't know. There's a pretty important distinction. And then something will work, and it might take a while to know what works, but then when it does, you'll know it.
Nice. On that note, are there any platforms or websites for our listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Sure. Yeah. My website is the easiest way. So that's just my name, AMY, Amy Hillis, HILLIS.com. You already said where my album is on Spotify. There's also a link on my website as well. A few different upcoming projects, like Megan and I have some more performances happening in the Maritimes, like Nova Scotia and Canada. And I'm actually performing at the Dubai Expo, World Expo next week. So that's
very
will be
cool.
An interesting experience.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's awesome.
So, some things on the go. But generally speaking, I think the wheels are slowly turning again. So hopefully more live performances start up, especially up here in Canada. It's taken a little long,
longer.
So.
Okay. Yeah. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button.
Sushi's just smashing the subscribe button for you,
Patty. Yeah, that was a cat crossing for anyone who didn't realize what was going on. In addition to Sushi's paw on the subscribe button, you can also subscribe to this podcast wherever you're tuning in. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Hide and Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HideIn Music Stand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at HideIn Music Stand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, HideInMusicStand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Thank you so much, Amy, for joining the show today. As you said earlier, it is just so wonderful to come back together and have a discussion about everything that we... Yeah, because that was such a precious time for, I think, so many of us at San Francisco Conservatory. And to have that incubator time, and now I'm just so impressed and proud of all the work you've done and what you're doing with music and violin playing. And I just wish you the best going forth. And let's keep in touch.
Hey, right back at you, Patty. Thanks so much for having me. Really a pleasure.
Yeah. All right. And thanks for listening. Say bye, Sushi.